May it please the court, I'm David Migliaccio, number 8404, representing Appellant TV in this case. This is a paternity case involving a contest between TV, who came to the case as the biological father and also the father by virtue of legitimacy and a relationship with the child, and Appellee TRS, who came to the case as the presumed father by virtue of having held the child out as his own and invited the child into his home. After hearing in October of 2009, Magistrate Erler of the El Paso County District Court determined that TRS was the father and thus cutting off the rights of TV. Magistrate Erler accomplished this by a preponderance of the evidence, and that's what Judge Shakes found on petition for review, and TV appealed. The specific issue today is whether TV's paternal rights may be cut off by less than clear and convincing evidence. We start with the plain language of the statute. And the statute is the paternity statute, specifically section 19-4-105-2A. The first part of 2A specifically says that a presumption under this section may be rebutted only by clear and convincing evidence.
Does the statute abrogate the rules of evidence?
No.
And here's the problem I'm wrestling with, Mr. Migliaccio. If I have a picture of TV stealing a necklace and going out the window, and I have another defendant who is caught with the necklace, and there's a presumption that that defendant stole the necklace, how can I ignore the picture of TV stealing the necklace? If there is conclusive proof by DNA that TV is the father, why do I have to worry about the presumptions that are raised in the paternity statute? I've got conclusive evidence that TV is the father.
It's interesting, that's a discussion that Justice Coates has in the dissent in NAH. That's exactly what Justice Coates was talking about. However, as a mere attorney, I think that I have to work within the confines of the statute. We can all agree that the paternity statute perhaps was not drafted as well as it might have been. But once the legislature launched off into the notion that it was going to create additional equal presumptions to biology and legitimacy, the two traditional presumptions, and the presumptions that usually find themselves on the opposite side of appellate cases. Once the legislature decided to do that, it's not a matter of abrogating the rules of evidence, it's a matter of we have to follow the statute, and the statute lays out, the statute says that it can't be done by less than clear, you can't rebut one of these presumptions by less than clear and convincing evidence.
You don't have to follow a statute that leads to an absurd result.
No, I don't think so. It's simply that the legislature, in its wisdom, decided, and by the way, we look at the first sentence in 2A and we say, why would the legislature specify clear and convincing evidence? And the simple reason is because the legislature was aware of the second tier of considerations here, which are the constitutional considerations. The legislature said, we're creating a scheme by which we may cut off the rights of a biological father.
Mr. Migliaccio, if I may interrupt. I am concerned, I agree that we have to look at what the legislature has done. And I am concerned, and if I would appreciate it if counsel for the appellee would address this issue too when she speaks. But I'm concerned that no one here is talking about subsequent amendments to the statute that occurred after NAH occurred. In 2003, the legislature completely revamped these statutes, including providing, I would submit to you, the possibility of a definition of the term of policy and logic that the Supreme Court correctly recognized was not talked about in the statute that existed in 2000. We now have factors that address that. In addition, in 2008, the legislature added 19.4107.3, and 1A specifically says that it focuses on DNA testing. And you can walk in after a paternity determination has been made and say, I have conclusive DNA testing here. And at that point, what happens then, the court will modify or set aside a prior paternity order as long as it's just and proper and in the best interests of the child. But hasn't the legislature, by the 2003 changes and this 2008 change, indicated, number one, that it recognizes the importance of the increased reliability of DNA testing, and two, hasn't it provided for us a different analysis than what the court used below when looking at the issues of logic and policy?
Yes, I think so. It's a simple case in one sense. It's a very difficult case in another sense, simply because you do have a child involved. This is not simply a matter of the parents. The best interests of a child have to be considered. I don't know that the legislature in its previous statute or in its amendments, or that the trial court or anybody knows exactly how to balance out the best interests of a child when you have, on one side, a parent who is the functional equivalent of a psychological parent for Title 14 purposes, and on the other side, you have a parent who enjoys the two strongest traditional presumptions known to law. And a statute that says, notwithstanding that these are very powerful presumptions, and notwithstanding also the new DNA considerations in the statutes, you still have a statute and a case law scheme that says no presumption is more important than another.
That's right, Mr. Migliaccio. Both of these presumed fathers come in with equal presumptions, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Under the statute, that is absolutely correct, and we do not deny that.
But the ultimate issue is paternity.
Yes.
And what we are engaged in is the application of a legislative theorem to determine paternity.
Correct.
When in fact we can determine paternity conclusively because of a DNA test.
And without going into what my own personal preferences would be, we left that behind, the legislature left that behind. When it decided, there's a Kentucky case that talks about NAH and actually rejects NAH, and I forget the name of the case, but that particular case, in Kentucky, biology is supreme. In Colorado, biology is not. This has left the judiciary with very difficult decisions, including the need to now make this decision between two presumed fathers on the basis of clear and convincing evidence. Judge Shake said, that's going to be a very hard decision, and what if I can't do it by clear and convincing evidence? With respect, that's why we have judges. Judges are here to make hard decisions, and this becomes a much harder decision when you start saying, well, biology is not supreme, neither is legitimacy. They're just presumptions, and they can be rebutted.
Mr. Migliaccio, do we also have the added, difficulty or burden in this case that it seems to me that on the record here, neither father or presumed father went after the other one to try to rebut the other's equal presumption?
I think that's true in the sense that it's not clear to me that anybody really had a clear grasp of what the paternity statute issues were. I mean, it's not a matter of having a grasp. It's one of the things, the way Magistrate Earle ran the case. That's why we have a problem with Magistrate Earle making this decision by a preponderance of the evidence, because it doesn't appear that he went to 2A and said, oh, we must do this by clear and convincing evidence. And so the litigants are left with a less than clear idea of what the issues are going to be for Magistrate Earle. Yes, I would agree with that. So, yes, this becomes a very difficult case. And again, the statute is less than clear. The statute imposes some seriously difficult burdens on judges who have to try and sort all this out, with the added complication that it has to be done in the best interest of the child. But I would still submit.
But let me ask you again, Mr. Migliaccio. I understand that's what NIH said, and I understand that, NIH is a Colorado Supreme Court case that binds us. But what if the legislature has stepped in and said, what you look to, as it did in 2003, when you're looking at policy and logic, is you look to these various circumstances. And aren't those more specific circumstances that can be said to be components of best interest of the child? I mean, when you read through those factors focus on the nature of the relationship, the extent of the relationship, when one party tried to come in and say, I'm the dad, you're not, a variety of things like that.
Certainly.
And if the legislature did intend to say these are the factors that policy and logic are to be considered, then hasn't the legislature, which I would submit to you, I think, if I'm wrong, please tell me, has the authority to supersede the Supreme Court in this regard? Haven't they provided a definition that the Supreme Court didn't have when it decided NIH? And if so, why wasn't that followed here?
Well, the Supreme Court has indeed, I think Magistrate Earler was looking at this list. He doesn't specifically say that he was looking at each particular instance of this list. But Magistrate Earler was looking at the list. He was aware of the list of factors, I think. What he does not seem to have been aware of, or does not seem to have applied consciously, because maybe he took the district court's position that a preponderance is acceptable, was the correct evidentiary standard, which is clear and convincing evidence. We have no quarrel with the notion that the legislature has tried to clarify what it meant by policy and logic. But policy and logic are not evidentiary standards. Clear and convincing evidence is. So when you look at these factors, well, first of all, so you have a two-tier analysis here. You have to first find that the competing presumptions attach, and find that by clear and convincing evidence. So if I have two sets of competing presumptions supported by clear and convincing evidence, then you have to go to the policy and logic, including the list of factors specified by the updated statute. But you still have to make a finding. And if you boil this down to say it's the best interest of the child, and I think you're correct that is essentially what this is about, it still has to be that the magistrate has to still make the decision that it is in the best interest of the child by clear and convincing evidence. Because if you don't, what you have is the statute says that a presumption is rebutted not by evidence, but by the court decree declaring paternity in the other parent.
So, counsel, I'll let you talk. Let me just ask a quick question here because you were on that track. You talked about, this two-step analysis in which first you determine whether, there's a presumption or a competing presumption by clear and convincing evidence. But whereas here, where nobody challenged the other father's presumption, can't we say that it is established because it wasn't challenged?
That the presumptions are established?
Yes, yes, and that they're established by clear and convincing evidence because
the presumptions are. So the first tier is that.
Okay, and so then we just go to application of the factors that are within the statute.
By clear and convincing evidence, yes.
So are you saying, Mr. Migliaccio, that the factors are established because nobody fought over them, or because there is evidence to establish each by clear and convincing evidence?
I think the latter.
Okay.
The latter. Let me reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deanne Kane Fishline, number 24889, appearing on behalf of TRS, who is an appellee respondent in this case. There are two of us who are going to speak today, so I'm just going to take a few minutes, if I may. And the crux of this case is just that which Mr. Migliaccio and Your Honors was discussing a moment ago. This is not a termination case. It is a case to establish the paternity of the child CLS in one of these two men, the appellant and the appellee TRS. There are the two potential fathers. We have three competing presumptions. TRS's presumption is based on him holding out the child and supporting him and establishing a relationship with him from a very early age. TV's presumptions are based on the genetic testing and the fact that he was married to the mother of the child at the time the child was born, even though they were going through a divorce at the time. And I believe, Judge Fox, your comments are particularly relevant to this case. Neither parent, neither father, potential father, even attempted to rebut the presumption of possible parentage in the other. The reality of it is, those three presumptions are facts. They're not, pretty clearly not rebuttable. The fact of DNA, the fact of the marriage being in existence, and the fact that TRS held the child out as his own. And Magistrate Earler made specific findings based on specific statutory provisions that that was the case. And pursuant to the statute, and I too look at this in terms of having a two-step process, step one is you have to rebut one of these presumptions or the presumptions that apply to any parent by clear and convincing evidence. That is the specific language of the statute. There is no way to do that in this case. So what the court has to do with their step two is they have to look at all of the facts and circumstances of the case, weigh them, do a balancing act, and determine how that is determined in the best interest of the child. So if you're going to look at it in that two-step process, I think the only way you can do that is by a preponderance of the evidence standard. If clear and convincing is the only way to rebut these presumptions, it becomes an impossibility.
Pardon me for interrupting,
yes,
Ms. King, but going back to my question, we had a change in 2003 after the 2000 decision. We now have a definition of what policy and logic means. Those, would you agree, those were the factors that the court should have applied to this case? Isn't that what the statute says?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And my view of this case is that that is what Magistrate Earler did, and that that is what Judge Shakes did in reviewing Magistrate Earler's determination.
We have no specific reference to any of them, do we?
I don't believe we do. I think you're absolutely right. But I believe that Magistrate Earler, in his ruling, did state that he reviewed the applicable statutes. And obviously, he didn't enumerate those, Your Honor, and I understand that.
But he did use the phrase best interests of the child, and this, obviously, I'm interested in this issue.
Absolutely.
Did the legislature intend, because remember, we had a void before, the legislature has filled the void. Did the legislature intend for those factors to now be what courts look at instead of best interests? Because they do focus on the child's welfare, specifically.
Absolutely, and I think those factors in the best interest of the child statute are certainly inclusive, but I don't believe they are exclusionary to other factors that the court looks at in the grand scheme of things when they are looking at the life of the child and the child's relationships with the people in his life and what is truly in the child's best interest with regard to his surroundings and his involvement with other people and entities. So I think, in fact, that I'm sure that is what the legislature intended, was the best interest factors are those which the court is to review in making that determination. And following on from that, when you're looking at the two-step application of the statute, from my client's perspective, the only way you can get to a determination in this kind of a case where you have pretty clearly established presumptions that really cannot factually be rebutted, the only way they are rebutted is by the entry of a decree finding that one man is the father of the child and not the other. That is the only way to do that. In this case, it's particularly relevant because initially what Mr. Migliaccio's argument is based on is the idea that biology and legitimacy give his client a leg up. They make his presumptions more important because he attaches constitutional protections to those two presumptions. And I believe NAH is very, very clear in that, that is not the case, and we cannot attach that kind of a right, a constitutional protection, to a presumption until there has been a finding. You can't terminate that which hasn't been created yet.
Ms. King, so do you agree that both fathers with their competing presumptions come in on equal footing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is the basis for our position. I am going to give the floor to Ms. Idle. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Christina Idle, attorney registration number 26334. I'm counsel for the El Paso County Child Support Enforcement Unit, the petitioner appellee. The Child Support Unit filed this action on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado in order to establish paternity for CLS. The Child Support Unit absolutely agrees that both of the respondents named in our petition came into the case on an equal footing as presumed fathers and in equal standing. In order to determine paternity, the court has to look at CRS 19-4-105. I don't think that's disputed. And the first two sentences are, I think, are what is at issue here. In particular, what standard of or evidentiary standard should be applied to the second sentence? I think it's undisputed in the first sentence to rebut a presumption. It's a clear and convincing evidence standard. And that in our case, none of the three presumptions left at the end of the proceeding based on Judge Shake's ruling, were rebutted. And so at the end of the proceeding, we had three competing presumptions, two with TV and one with TRS. So the Child Support's position that those presumptions are equal. And, biology is not conclusive. I think that issue was discussed clearly in NAH versus SLS. I think when the General Assembly revised or amended CRS 19-4-105 in 2003 to clarify what policy and logic is, at that time they could have addressed the issue of whether paternity or biology, was conclusory, and they did not do so.
So Ms. Igel, even under a preponderance standard, two presumptions are the same as one presumption.
I think that's a possibility.
As a matter of fact, it's even worse than that. One presumption, by a preponderance of the evidence, and the best interest of the child, wins over two presumptions.
Well, that's what happened in this matter. The court found that the one presumption held by TRS was the weightier on the considerations of policy and logic. I agree that Magistrate Erler did not specifically go through the factors. I believe he did reference that he had reviewed and had considered the factors, but the court found that the court didn't specify a preponderance of the evidence standard. District Court Judge Shakes found that that's what the court must have
found. As a matter of policy and logic, made that finding.
Correct. When looking at
pardon me, counsel.
Yes.
We're sort of busy today. I'm sorry. The legislature may not have said anything specifically about genetic testing in 1904 when it made changes in 2003, but it did make changes to the evidentiary statute in Title 13, although it said that it created a presumption. But I'm also interested, as I said to Mr. Migliaccio, about the 2008 change, which basically says that if I've got a DNA test that says I'm the dad, and there's previously been a determination of paternity, that DNA test is powerful enough that I can walk into court and say, let's upset the apple cart, and the court has to make a determination that it's just under the circumstances and in the best interests of the kid. But that DNA test is a powerful thing. It says that I may be adjudicated the dad now, even though a dad was previously adjudicated. Doesn't that tell you that the legislature has some feeling that the biological considerations are important?
I think that biology is obviously a very important consideration for the child as well as to the parents of the child, but I think two things. In the first, in 2003, when the court did revise 19-4-105 as well as 1325-126, Justice Coates in his dissent noted that there was a provision in 1325-126 that stated the presumption of legitimacy is rebutted basically by genetic testing showing that somebody else is the father. When they made the revisions in 2003, they added subsection I, the presumption of legitimacy of a child born during wedlock may be overcome as provided in section 19-4-105-2A if the court finds that the conclusion of the experts, et cetera, shows that the husband or wife is not the parent of the child. So again, I think the General Assembly had an opportunity in 2003 when making these changes to say that genetic testing was conclusory and did not do so. The 2008 provisions, I believe, are the paternity disestablishment provisions. And they go, I think, more to not to someone coming in and saying, I'm the father, and to upset the apple cart, but to go into saying that somebody who's already under a pre-existing order can come in and say, I have these DNA test results excluding me as the father and showing I am not the father. There's a subsection, for example, that says that if you sign to be on the birth certificate knowing that you're not the father, you cannot use those provisions in the statute. And I apologize if I'm confusing under the Uniform Parentage Act, and there's also a provision that was amended at the same time under Title 14, 1410.122 subsection 6, I believe, although I may be incorrect on the subsection.
But nonetheless, my point is that it's a powerful enough thing to say we're going to change an order. A DNA test is a powerful enough thing.
I agree, but I believe that if you're establishing paternity as we are in this case, and there already was DNA testing and there was no issue as to who was the father, the statute in 1904.105 subsection 2 is still clear. That's just a presumption. That at the establishment phase of the proceeding, that's a presumption, and that TV and TRS came in on an equal footing, and there were no extra weight given to TV because he was the biological parent. In determining what level of evidentiary standard should be applied, United States Supreme Court in Santosky versus Kramer had stated that one of the factors under Matthews versus Eldridge is the risk of error. And it stated that the standard of proof allocates the risk of error between the parties. And it's discussing cases like in Santosky where there was a termination of parental rights, which TV claims is what happened here. But in that case, the risk of error was being allocated between the state and a party. And in this case, the risk of error is being allocated between the two presumptive fathers. Their paternity actions where the state isn't a party. And so the risk of error in this case is between the two respondents. And I think the two respondents, since they came in on equal footing, it's logical that that would be a preponderance of the evidence standard when weighing the two competing presumptions, or in this case, three competing presumptions. The Child Support Unit would ask the court to uphold the district court's ruling that the court properly use a preponderance of the evidence standard, and that when weighing competing presumptions, preponderance of the evidence standard is the correct standard to be used. And that was all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eichel. Mr. Migliaccio, you have about a minute and a quarter.
Thank you.
Before you dive into your minute and a quarter, can you just answer one quick question that I've got? And I'd like some clarification about what relief it is that your client actually is seeking. And I'm looking at page 2 of your opening brief where you emphasize that, TV emphasizes that he's not asking the court for any ruling beyond establishment of the proper standard of proof under 19.4.405.2 subsection A. Is that what you're asking for?
Reversed and remanded for a new hearing under the proper evidentiary standard. That's it. That's what we're asking for.
Is that because you think that you would prevail under the different evidence?
It's possible. Because we need to talk, first of all, about rebuttal. The statute's clear about what is rebuttal. It is not correct that the presumptions, because they stand up until the court's order, are not rebutted. The court's order rebuts them. That's what the statute says. That the presumption is rebutted by an order establishing paternity in another person. Also, looking at the factors that you mentioned, Judge Bernard, that is not an exclusive list of factors. It is including but not limited to the following. Those are best interest factors, but there are other policies, for example, that Judge Erler apparently didn't consider, such as the fact that there is a strong policy in favor of legitimacy. There's a policy factor for you that needs to be considered here. I see that I'm just about out of time, so I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Migliaccio. Thank you again, Ms. Kane and Ms. Eichel. Your arguments were excellent and very helpful to the court, so we thank you for that. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written order to issue in due course.